I'm Christopher Leiden. This is Open Source. World War I began a century ago, and still we hear it and feel it in the music that came out of the rubble. From Americans in Paris and Frenchmen in Harlem, it's the music of concert halls and speakeasies. Spindly Maurice Ravel, who had driven an army truck in the war, wrote a suite of piano elegies for seven friends who had died in battle. Igor Stravinsky, after his explosive Rite of Spring, wrote a humble soldier's tale about a broken warrior's deal with the devil. The noises of war are in the music. Plane propellers, sirens, an army of player pianos in one of the wildest pieces of the period, the Ballet Mécanique. Modernism becomes jazz in the music of Erik Satie and Bessie Smith, Kurt Weill and Duke Ellington. Mournful, defiant, and beautiful. The living record of devastation and transformation. It's the sound of the modern era being hatched in Paris, Berlin, Vienna, and New York by new stars, many of them women. Ma Rainey, Amy Beach, Mae West, Josephine Baker in the mix with Ravel and Gershwin. Virginia Eskin will introduce the era. Gil Rose of the Boston Modern Orchestra Project will conduct us through a bizarre American monument from France, the Ballet Mécanique. The young musical historian at Tufts, Stefan Pennington, will argue that we're listening to the first global youth culture. And the jazz band leader and historian Lauren Schoenberg will bring it all back to modernism in American music. We begin at home in Boston with the virtuoso pianist and talker, Virginia Eskin. We're asking her to transport us to shell-shocked Paris in the early 1920s.
So I'm playing Ravel, a little bit of Undine from Gaspard de la Nuit. And for me, that kind of swirling quality is what epitomizes the huge change that happened in music between the world wars. The enormous use of beautiful ninth chords. You know what that's
from. We think of those as jazz chords too, right?
You know, you take a little walk around the park with those sexy chords, and you immediately know that you're in the 20th century. People need to be perked up. World War I is a devastation of everybody. So what happens, they realize people like jazz hall. They like to go out and be entertained, forget the horrors that have happened. But these serious composers, French, European, and American, they can't completely turn their back on classical structure. So what they do then is jam it together, and the filter becomes dance hall music or something that's considered popular or populist, much easier to take. It's almost unbelievably rich with all these flows, and we haven't even touched on jazz because that's making this huge imprint. You can't just talk about Impressionism. That is the big thing that's happening at that time in sound, and it overlaps into jazz, and jazz overlaps into Impressionism. Smarming around as you're it's like a woman with hot flashes. It's like the earth or volcanic stuff. Very, very, very accessible, very easy to love.
Physical,
visceral, right. But then you have this, and it doesn't happen any other time. That's why you love this period. That's why we all do, because it's shot through with these strange little, like the novelties period, that's happening. Or you have the little squeegees, the Webern, those little sort of you know, secretions, those sound, you go. I'm just making that up, but that could have been Poulenc, it could have been Auric, it could have been Taillefer.
Come back to the 20s, Virginia, and remember how shattered a time it was. I'm thinking Ravel, himself described as frail, but he gets himself a truck assignment in the war, and he ends up writing this Tombeau de Couperin about friends of his who died. This is a dark time.
It is a dark time, and he also writes the famous violin sonata, which has pure smarm sort of in it. Like the second movement, the violin is requested, the violinist, to take the violin and play it like a guitar. That's the violin. And then I come in. I take over the chords and the violin comes in. It's very, very sad. And the chords are like a heartbeat. They continue through the... Nobody had heard music like that in a classical setting. And then it's pure Ravel because it becomes very magical. It goes. And what Ravel is showing is his genius for orchestration. And Debussy had it also. And they compose at the piano. The piano is just as all Brahms, Beethoven, all great composers use the piano, sort of as like it's their laptop. So they're not fools. They know this is going to be the new sound, the new music. But how do we put it into our old filter? And they do it brilliantly. And of course, the French people were interested in fog, rains, you know, and that gets into a whole nest of pedaling. That. How long do you keep the pedal down before it gets really messy? It's like watercoloring. And the fingers become like brushes. You're brushing the sound. These guys are inventing stuff, you know, every week that's going to blow the lid off what went before that. Nobody wants that anymore. You know, they want. It's the desire to be different, be profound, but change the rules. So they're stealing all the time from each other. All composers want to have their own sound, but what happens in this period between the world wars, they're not bothered defining that anymore. You know, Mio comes to this country, he goes down to Brazil. That's when he meets the great tango composer, Ernesto Nazareth. You know, all those wonderful tangos. Very beautiful pieces.
Paris, 1922.
Yes!
Proust is writing The Night Away in search of lost time, and there's so much music, concerts,
he
just like
many
the ones
Madeleines.
You're describing.
It's yeah, his problem.
This mysterious music is all through his book. He has a composite composer, he calls him Ventoil, and he's some piece of Debussy, Poulenc, Ravel, but especially, I think, Satie. I want to hear some Satie in this whole mix.
For me, it's very static. I love the word stasis. It's, you know, them. I'm just making that up, by the way, because
you're kidding.
But it sounds like it. I fooled you. No, here, I'll play this.
But let me just say, Satie is for me the Paul Klee of music. Very angular,
yes.
Very minimal.
Very minimal. Very,
very,
minimal.
Very thoughtful.
Two chords, no melody. That's
really?
Pretty minimal.
Okay.
It's about as minimal as you get.
So that was Eskin Satie.
That's why children can play it and they sound profound.
Let's hear Satie.
Yeah, this is Gnosienne number 2 from Music. Tonality there. A little lemon juice. That music lets your mind wander. This music is more like what drugs do for you. They take you out of yourself instead of putting yourself in the action. For me, they're like floating. It's sort of like a mushroom trip.
Dead on. I mean, this is Marcel's music. He goes to a concert late in the Proust saga, and he's totally bewitched by one phrase of a composer he sort of knows.
Yeah.
And this phrase keeps coming back, and he's completely lost. Then there's an intermission. And the conversation in the intermission is so banal, so stupid, so mindless. He wants to, like, go away. I'm on a musical trip. And then he has this gorgeous reflection on what if? What if the human species had evolved differently? Not rational, not linear, not verbal. What if our souls communicated through music?
That kind of...
This is the third in a radio series on what World War I did to our heads, to our ears this hour, the post-traumatic music that gushes up from Europe and the States after World War I. Our guest, Gil Rose, has made a mark recording a landmark piece of the era. It's the Ballet Mécanique, written by the American modernist Georges Antheil, first performed in Paris in 1924. It's a long, raucous way from the music that Maurice Ravel brought out of the war, as you're going to hear. Gil Rose conducts BMOP, the Boston Modern Orchestra Project. I asked him to get us from the war's devastation to the sound of player pianos and airplane propellers in Antheil's Mechanical Ballet.
Well, I think that you have to look backwards a little bit, even before the war, to a period of big Germanic music. Even French composers like César Franck and others, were Camille Saint-Saëns, were modeling their music under a Germanic compositional model. Before the war, Debussy comes in, starts to change the recipe a little bit, using different kinds of ways of constructing music, whether it be motific or harmonic and melodic, and then the war.
And of course, people say Stravinsky, too, blew it all open with The Rite of Spring.
Well, Stravinsky is part of it, and in fact, the war and The Rite of Spring, in the kind of war that it is all by itself, start... The forces together launch a movement, in a sense, because until that moment, you know, you have a Germanic development in music, and then you have something new starting with Debussy, but the cataclysm of the war and the cultural change. You know, all the music before the war, or not all of it, but certainly a great deal of it, was about celebrating something, or being an exponent of something, or aggrandizing the human spirit and condition. And after the tragedy of the First World War, immediately that has been debunked, as we see it in visual art and in literary art, and of course in music too. And in a sense, The Rite of Spring happens just around the same time, a little bit before actually, and that creates two forces, which is a sort of disillusioned intellectual artistic class, along with this giant explosion of the Rite of Spring, which overnight, though Stravinsky was famous before it, he became all that much more famous after it. And so there was a generation of composers who sought to write the piece that would put them, what I call, getting to the top of the bad boy heap. It made Stravinsky famous, and others realized that if music shocked and challenged, that it would get noticed.
Everybody mentions the Rite of Spring. At the neglect of Stravinsky's post-war piece, the famous Soldier's Tale. What's that connection?
Yeah, the Soldier's Tale is a sort of a launching off of a point also, because it is a direct reaction to the First World War. It is a story of a soldier coming home from war, and then the deal he makes with the devil. But the story isn't the only change. The musical language is a great change also. You go from the 104 players of the Rite of Spring to 7 players of the Soldier's Tale. Simple instrumentation, a narration, use of all sorts of popular musical forms, waltzes, tangos. I think that you start down a path of music taking on a different role. The role is no longer to toe the company line, because the pre-war company line ended up in the trenches in France and Belgium. When you put all these little recipes together, a reactionary Stravinsky coming off the war and writing Soldier's Tale or Les Noces or any of these pieces, and you throw in a really ambitious and rather showman, show-oriented character like George Antheil, and you get the possibility of the Ballet Mécanique.
Introduce George Antheil.
Paterson, New Jersey.
Famous place, Carlos Williams.
Yes. Wunderkind, off to Paris to make his fame and fortune, did have a predilection for shocking people, and was known for playing piano recitals and putting a revolver on the top of the piano before he started.
Chekhov says if you put it on the piano, you got to fire it before the play is over.
Yeah, he definitely understood the show and how to make a statement and grab an audience. So he envisions this this piece, which had his fatal flaw, which is part of the talking about how the piece is played, but it was for multiple coordinated player pianos, kind of player pianos you see in old movies where there's the reel and the dots, and they were quite common. People had them in their living room, and he has the idea that he'll set 16 or 32 or 24, some multiple of four, out on the stage and put them all in motion, and throw in a couple airplane propellers and some sirens, and he'd make a real industrial mechanical noise, which he did. But he didn't calculate on one fact, which is that the player pianos are not their mechanical devices. So once they could be started at the same time, they weren't exactly functioning at the same level of efficiency. And so within a matter of a minute, they were uncoordinated. And one would play slightly faster, one would play slightly slower, and by the time you got a few minutes into the piece, there was no coordination at all. They had disassembled in a way. Now, Charles Ives would have loved that, but that wasn't what George Antheil was going for. So he was forced to do a performance that required live players to play the pianos, and thus reducing the sort of sonic impact. But he still had the percussion and the airplane propellers and the mechanical noises and sirens and bells and whistles. And it was a scandal. Just what he wanted. Perfect. And then he brought it to New York, and it was a different kind of scandal, quite a disaster in his Carnegie Hall debut.
So how bad is bad?
I think it was unlike a riot where I think the Parisian riots were special kinds of riots because they would have these riots right of spring. I had a riot, but the next night the whole theater was full again because everybody wanted to see what it was all about. And I think in New York it didn't have that effect. It just disappeared.
It's music of the age of machines, the age of aviation. I know it only because you recorded it. I want to know why you were drawn to it and what you find in it for 21st century listeners.
You know, it's funny. It's like one of those pieces that as a younger man I always knew of, and I knew I had a recording somewhere of the smaller realized chamber version, and I knew the tale of it. You know, it's one of those legendary tales. But I had never thought it was possible to do it. The way it works now is that the conductor actually and the player pianos are synchronized. The conductor wears a headset where there's a click track. So he's conducting in sync with the player pianos. Quite a devilish little metrical exercise, I can tell you. And then the live players are following the conductor. They don't hear the click track. They just watch the conductor. And so all the insanity is brought under the realm of this little laptop that sits on stage and makes all these player pianos go. And they're fun to watch because you can lift up the lids and it's sort of like the dancing water fountain in front of, Caesar's Palace where the keys go left, keys go up and down in all these formations, and it's quite a show.
What did people make of it in Symphony Hall?
Well, one of the funny things about the Symphony Hall performance was actually in the rehearsal because there's a siren, which is an air raid siren, in the piece. And the siren went off and people left their offices in Symphony Hall because they thought it was a fire drill. So that was a lot of fun that day. People went crazy. It's a visceral experience. It's a little bit like having your head beaten by a frying pan for 35 minutes. It's a sonic assault. It is loud, cacophonous. Antheil writes about what his intentions were for the piece, to try to, expose another dimension in sound. I mean, this idea of these sound experiments also comes out of this era and sort of Scriabin-esque in the way that the sound was seen as a pathway and a channel to another level of reality. And so he was all mixed up in that. How much of that was for show and for good copy in the paper and how much he believed, it's hard to say. He had an interesting career afterwards. He became a code breaker for the United States government. And he was a spy and quite an interesting character. And then he was a Hollywood film scorer.
What was the talent that linked those roles?
Yeah, well, I think that, the tinkerer and, to even get the idea of this intricate mechanical connection. He was a brilliant man, clearly. Not all his experiments were founded in good reason, but this one, you know, this one had a ninth inning.
He and this piece get filed under Dada.
Yeah.
Explain those connections.
Well, yeah, I'm not so sure. I mean, Dada as the movements in the 20s, and a lot of this comes out of Italy, the idea that the meaning of something is just so ridiculous that the impact comes out of the meaninglessness of the experience. It's hard to say with him. You know, this is also an era where there is this fascination with industrialization, and which is even you know, we're talking a lot about the effects of the First World War, and we talk about the Rite of Spring, but we also have to talk about the same thing, the other earth-shattering event going on at the same time, which is the Russian Revolution. So there, you know, this is all in the mix, and this idea of an industrialized society and power through industrialization and human expression through the mechanization of the world is feeding into his inspiration, I'm sure.
For me, the essay question, Gil Rose, is sort of what is the underlying spirit of this post-war music? I mean, is it devastated? Is it traumatized? Is it avant-garde, which it surely was? Is it looking forward? Is it full of dread? What kind of anticipation here?
You know, there's all these different manifestations of it, but there's a certain aggression in it. You know, there's a certain anger and reaction in it. Composers who were just lashing out and lashing forward, if there's such a... I mean, they did sow the seeds of the next 100 years of music in a way. I mean, you have various streams. You have the Schoenberg Second Viennese School theme, which is really a continuation in many ways of the German Romantic ideal. The followers of Satie who are not looking for any romantic ideal, but music as the idea expressing a complete disillusionment with conventional society that leads onward into other schools. And then you have these Stravinsky followers of the Rite of Spring. I think that for me, the Ballet Mécanique is most connected to the Rite of Spring, much more than these other movements, because I think in the Rite of Spring, Anthau saw a model for a musical expression that was impactful and also created scandal. He was not averse to the scandal.
Last thought, maybe. Aren't we ready for a new post-war real modernism? From where you stand on the podium of the Modern Orchestra Project, do you ever sense an appetite out there in the audience for a brand new broom that would sweep it all anew, even as Stravinsky did with the Rite of Spring? I mean, let's start again.
Right, right.
We're in a new place.
Yeah, what's the new? Well, I mean, I'm sure there are any number of composers out there who are thinking about this question themselves. Because as people get the opportunity to write a major piece, I don't know any composer worth their salt who doesn't want to write something new and something that changes things. That's why they're writing.
You know. But I'm thinking something on the Joycean scale in Ulysses, something that says no to the church, no to Papa, no to the empire, to Ireland. But, I'm out of here.
Yeah, but before Ulysses, who could have imagined it? The day before Ulysses was public knowledge, who could have imagined it? The same thing with the Rite of Spring. The day before the Rite of Spring was played, who could have imagined it? So as much new music as I've heard in my time, if there's something new to imagine, it's going to be a composer who imagines it, not a conductor.
Call us when you hear it, will you?
I will. It's my job to identify it and grab it real quick. But it's that composer or writer or painter who will, for some reason, and often because of a reaction to some major, you know, world event, do something completely new.
Gil Rose mentioned in an aside the great Kurt Weill, the musical love child, he said, of Erik Satie and Arnold Schoenberg with little George Gershwin thrown in. In Germany, Kurt Weill was the composer of the Threepenny Opera, Mack the Knife, and all that, with Bertolt Brecht in 1928. In America, he wrote shows and classic show tunes like this one, My Ship. This is Miles Davis in the Gil Evans arrangement of My Ship in 1957. Coming up, the transatlantic fusions of modernism and jazz, and a question: how is it that James Joyce and Duke Ellington were never seen together? I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source on the messages in the music that came out of World War I. The musical and social historian Stefan Pennington is here to remind us that the new rhythm that the world was dancing to in 1925 was wrapped up in the Charleston, written and performed here by James P. Johnson, the original stride pianist.
When I think about the World War I, I think immediately beforehand when you have the beginnings of this rise of technology that then explodes during the wartime and then afterwards, right? You have the beginning of globalization, you have airplane travel, you have radio, you have recorded sound. So people are really excited about the modern time period. It brings with it fashion, it brings with it changes in social mores. When you have this younger generation of people who for the very first time are being marketed to, right, with sort of modern marketing techniques and identifying themselves as a youth generation, who you have young women now taking off their corsets, cutting their hair short, young men wearing rouge, and this group of people on both sides of the Atlantic and also the Pacific, they were too young to fight in World War I, but they were not too young to see its effects. So they're on the streets of Paris or of Berlin or London and seeing people with no limbs on the street. They remember all of the sort of stories of heroism of how great World War I is going to be. Or if they're black in the United States, about how they're going to have perhaps emancipation after World War I, and that didn't happen. So there are all these sorts of promises that were made for this old, from the old generation, that this new generation knows not to be true. And they end up rebelling completely. And with that, you sort of create this brand new sort of music, dance culture, entertainment culture that changes everything.
Give us a sound of it. The streets of Paris. And let's remember, it's also an incredibly post-traumatic moment, too.
It is the trauma of the war led to a real break. So there was this idea that there is no culture left, that the culture that was created by Europe only led to death, only led to destruction, and there had to be some other way of sort of creating a sense of self, a sense of being. For the young Europeans, they ended up embracing then Americanism, what was called Americanism. So they would embrace Harold Lloyd and Charlie Chaplin, they would embrace the Charleston, the blues, saxophones and banjos, jazz, jazz dance.
Explain the traffic back and forth across the Atlantic. I mean, Django Reinhardt comes from Europe to be a jazz star in this country. George Antheil goes to Europe to write the Ballet Mécanique. Ravel comes here, meets Gershwin. Gershwin and Duke Ellington meet him in Europe too. What is that all about?
Well, you can start with James Reese Europe, the
Please.
Ragtime band leader, although people would also think of him as the first jazz band leader as well. And when World War I happened, he formed the Hellfighters, which was an infantry unit, which was a band, and he got the best musicians in Harlem to come together to make a military band. They get sent overseas to Europe, and they play what is this... At this moment, somewhere between ragtime and jazz, the line is very, very blurry, sort of at this moment. They go overseas, they play the French freak out. They have no idea how in the world could they make these sounds with these instruments. They thought maybe there was some kind of strange, suspicious sort of mouthpiece on the trumpets so they could get these sort of dirty sounds that they'd never heard of before. And at that moment, Europeans become a little bit obsessed with this sort of new sound of jazz, this sort of early big band-ish military band sound. Mm. And from that moment, you have people trying to sort of copy that sound, and what we think of as jazz starts spreading already in like 1918, 1919 to Europe. And of course, you have art music composers like Ravel and being inspired by the sort of new jazz sound. And a lot of sort of art music people thought, oh, we can take this new vital idea and we can use that as the building blocks for our art music. Mm-hmm. But the vast majority of people said, no, no, we don't want that. We want to dance the night away in these clubs, in these cabarets, in these music halls in Europe.
The women that are emerging in completely new ways in this traffic. Mm. Josephine Baker, for example, but Bessie Smith, Ma Rainey, Ethel Waters, who has several careers here, but a lot of them.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, what was so amazing about thinking about women, I think you have the emergence of all of these types of new women. You have bold, brassy women who you might think of as blues women or Red Hot Mamas. So you might think of somebody like Sophie Tucker or Mae West as a Red Hot Mama who would sing openly about what kind of sexual activity they wanted to have, when they wanted to have it, with whom they wanted to have it.
What were the songs, for example?
Oh, Mae West's I Like a Guy What Takes His Time, which is exactly what you might think it is.
A guy what takes his time, I'll go for any time. I'm a fast-moving girl that likes them slow.
When you think of an embodiment of that moment, that spirit, who do you think of?
I think of Josephine Baker. She had one of the largest global impacts. She toured all over the world. She was the one who brought the Charleston to Europe. She went to Cuba. She went to Brazil. Many people would think of her as the iconic sort of symbol of jazz. And she was a singer, she was a dancer. She represents sort of this changing sense of a space for black people to have some emancipation, for women to have emancipation, sort of global reach. It was sort of amazing how much of an impact she had. And she adopted children from all over the world. She had a rainbow tribe, and she was sort of openly bisexual, and she did what she wanted. She walked through town with a cheetah, like on a leash. She was like, I'm gonna be Josephine Baker in Paris. And she was able to have a kind of autonomy and able to be while representing the sort of dream of America for so many people.
Lauren Schoenberg is a one-of-a-kind historian of 20th century music because, though he is still young in his 50s, he has lived it all. He took piano lessons as a teenager from two jazz giants, Teddy Wilson and Hank Jones. When Benny Goodman, the late King of Swing, as they called him, made his last big appearance on PBS, he was playing in Lauren Schoenberg's band. Mr. Schoenberg is the artistic director of the National Jazz Museum in Harlem. He won his Grammy for writing about the music. I'm asking him to wrap up the century after World War I, both sides of the Atlantic, and the traffic of masters and masterpieces back and forth.
Couldn't you give me a hard question? starting with Brahms and Bartok, I mean, of course there were others. But the late 19th century, you know, here are two great composers who are really trying to put the fingerprint, cultural fingerprint into their music that is absolutely undeniable. Bartok, of course, is going way into the hills to integrate into his concert music, vestiges of music from the hills and from all kinds of people who are not part of the audience who'd be listening to the music in the concert hall. It's very interesting. And over here in America, of course, you have Allington doing the same thing a little bit later. And I know that he felt very strongly about the fact that his music was going to represent his people as much as I think Bartok's. I think the big difference is that Allington and the jazz guys, Armstrong, Allington, and the early geniuses who created the idiom, were doing what they were doing in vernacular music, in music that no one was going to sit and listen to sitting still in the concert hall, consciously listening to art music.
Hmm.
You know, it's kind of interesting to think in terms of, I've been trying to, thinking about that question of yours, to bring it all together, to try and think, you know, was there a physical space where these things came together? Was there one place where all these feet trod, where all these sounds were heard? And, you know, it's really, it would probably be Carnegie Hall, because that's where Armstrong played, where Ellington premiered come Sunday, where Lester Young and Charlie Christian jammed, where Fats Waller and James P. Johnson played. So actually, it's kind of funny that right here in a hall built by a Scottish immigrant,
interesting.
That place was where all these people met. Interesting.
Thelonious Monk, John Coltrane.
Those same boards.
Here's another link, Lauren Schoenberg, and it fascinates me. James Joyce, father in many ways of the great modernist tradition, age 32, finishing his portrait of the artist as a young man, he has his hero leaving Ireland saying bye-bye, but also almost the last lines, welcome, O life, I go to encounter the reality of experience and to forge on the smithy of my soul the uncreated conscience of my race. Duke Ellington, a few years later, but he's 32. He writes for an English jazz magazine called Rhythm. He says, the history of my people is one of great achievements over fearful odds. And then he says, I am therefore now engaged on a rhapsody unhampered by any musical form in which I intend to portray the experiences of the colored races in America in a syncopated rhythm in the hope that I shall achieve something really worthwhile in the literature of music and that an authentic record of my race by a member of it shall be placed on record.
Absolutely fascinating. The one thing that really unites them is this desire to create in a new idiom, to integrate the vernacular way of expressing themselves, to not really, well, on the one hand, to not really give a damn about the quote-unquote tradition, but on the other hand, they come right out of the tradition, deeply schooled and deeply knowledgeable about everything that preceded them. And yet they create these works that spoke in a new way. It's a fascinating idea, and I did not know that they were linked like that.
Well, it's so funny that Ellington calls it a rhapsody, and it might have been the Creole Rhapsody, which he wrote about the same time. Rhapsody, you know, old European musical term. But he's also saying in the same sentence, unhampered by any musical form. He's also connecting with literature and the Harlem Renaissance, dance hall music, but well beyond it, coming from an oppressed people. I mean, it's the whole manifesto. I'm just wondering, I mean, can we speak of a transnational kinship of the great moderns?
I don't see why we can't, especially since we're talking about an era that is greatly informed by mass media. I mean, if we were talking about the year 1800, I don't know, even 1900. But if we're talking about Ellington and Joyce and we're getting into the 20th century and we're getting to the fact that people could easily access and read what people were writing around the world, or at least much easier than before, and that people could hear the sounds that were emanating from New Orleans and from New York, Armstrong and Ellington and the others, and hear them around the world. And we know that their effects were felt. I mean, vis-a-vis Django Reinhardt in 1930, this Belgian gypsy, and you know, having a light bulb going on in his head and becoming a bona fide jazz original genius, having never set foot here, that I think that, yeah, sure. I think, and it's, of course, also those exact same technological innovations that made World War One the horror that it was. So I guess it all really kind of comes together.
Lauren Sherberg, I'm just wondering, you know, when you think of the century as a unit, starting with World War One and then the modernist impulse through it and after it to kind of turn the page on all of it, is it fair to think of jazz as the fulfillment of modernism? And I mean, what happened to modernism? It went to America and called itself jazz with that adversarial spirit, but also coming out of the vernacular and becoming renewed by the civil rights movement in the 60s. I think of Sonny Rollins and his Freedom Suites as the music of opposition, but in the end of huge beauty too.
Yes. There's a wonderful book by Alfred Appel called Jazz Modernism, From Armstrong and Ellington to Matisse and Joyce. And you mentioned the turning of a page. Yes, I think that the sound of jazz, as it evolved in the 20th century, is the sound of a page turning from the aristocratically based, the elite based art forms of what we call classical music, which it really still is. Just look at the audience.
Imagine Joyce, who was a showman, who was a singer, who knew all the vernacular Irish music of his world. Imagine him listening to an Ellington performance in the 20s.
You know, I think Ellington reading James Joyce at his best, Ellington had the kind of ears that would have divined and heard in all of that, the music and the beauty and the poetry. And it's hard for me to imagine that James Joyce, if we could imagine a meeting place somewhere along the road where they could have met and where James Joyce could have heard those strange sounds and those muted horns and the blues and those unusual harmonies. And above all, in common parlance, we might say the vibration of Ellington's music. It's not at all hard for me to imagine these two people and these two minds merging. Absolutely, because in a sense, they're both saying some of the same things. Another thing I think that really unites Joyce and Ellington is that they reveled in the sounds and the experiences that they grew up around. They didn't want to look at it from the top down. They wanted to bring all those things that they brought into the music and into the writing. But the problem there is, of course, is that we're talking about high and low. And that is something that really, I think, drove Ellington and Joyce to distraction, to demolish those things and to realize that low is high and high is low.
Yeah, better to speak of in and out. And they were both wonderfully out, even though they're now at the top of the canon. I mean, Joyce was banned in this country for the first 12 years of Ulysses. Duke Ellington was specifically rejected for a Pulitzer Prize by Columbia University trustees because we don't traffic in that kind of music.
Yeah. I don't think it's at all hard to understand how the police of high culture would not want to include someone like James Joyce when his work came out, and certainly Ellington, who had that great line in 1965 when he was 66 years old, when he was denied the Pulitzer Prize, and he said, "Fate is being kind to me. Fate doesn't want me to be too famous too young," or something along those lines.
That was exactly it.
Right. And now how ironic and how wonderful that Joyce and Ellington are at the absolute zenith of the pantheon, at the zenith of the canon of who one must read and one must listen to.
We started with Proust and Satie. We've ended with Joyce and Ellington. If we haven't made sense of a century, maybe at least we've made sense of an hour. Thank you, Lauren Schoenberg. Thank you, Stefan Pennington. Thanks also to Gil Rose and Virginia Eskin. This is the third in a series of programs on the Great War and its aftershocks. You can find the others on our website, radioopensource.org, where there's lots more, including a music playlist, a reading list, and talks with curators and bloggers about the images that show them everything about that world at war. This hour was produced and edited by Connor Gillies with help from Max Larkin. It was mixed by George Hicks. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.